Anita, how's your mental health?
Questionable at all times, you know this.
Yeah, how's the mental health of your children?
Also a little bit tricky. Can I tell you my experience in trying to find therapists for myself and my kids, Mel?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is how it goes. You ask around your friends and your family for a referral for somebody who's nearby. You finally find somebody who sounds like they might work for your family. You give them a call and you find out that A, they're not accepting new patients, or B, they have a huge wait list. So you start over again and you ask people if they know anybody who would be a good therapist and a good fit. Finally, you find one, you go and you meet with them, and you figure out that you don't actually like them that much. But it's been so much work to find somebody who you can go to in your area that you're kind of stuck with them. Well, do you have any ideas for how to get around this?
I do because guess what? I've actually had some therapists that I have found on my own, which involves what you're saying. Sometimes I remember one time I was like 3 hours in the bathtub on my phone looking through websites. I was such a prune at the end. But I have also had the experience with working with BetterHelp, and it was like I don't want to say too good to be true, but because it is true, but it's like amazing because I was matched with my therapist within 24 hours.
And you didn't have to go through all of that other ridiculous process of trying to find somebody. And here's the cool thing, too, is if that person didn't work out for you, you can just switch and say, and it's not like you're committing to another years long search for somebody who you're going to jive with.
That's true. And I lucked out, or maybe just BetterHelp is really good at matching people together because I never had to change my therapist. I loved her, perfect fit for me. And I know that some of our friends have used BetterHelp and they've had to change therapists, and boom, same day, you can change.
Easy
You can ghost your therapist, get a
peasy.
new one.
I love this idea. BetterHelp is one of our sponsors. If you use our promo code trybetterhelp.com/WWDN, you get 10% off your first month, and we totally recommend it.
Yes, get some therapy. That's
Ha.
trybetterhelp.com/WWDN.
This is an exciting day, Mel. We have a distinguished guest. Do you want to know why I think she's distinguished?
Yes.
Because her name is Judy, and I've never met a Judy who's not distinguished. So she's either going to prove me right or way wrong, and we're going to find out in the next 30 minutes.
Judy, will you tell us? Well, we know your name's Judy. What's your last name and where are you?
My last name is Condi, spelled Condie. No, the family don't know the origins, but we think it's Scottish, although we don't have any known Scottish relatives. And I'm from Surrey, which is in the south of England.
Is that where you're now?
That's where I am now, and that's where I've spent my life. I'm within a few miles of where I was born. So I've spent my whole life in the southeast of England. Not far from the coast, not far from the city of London. England's a very small place, and it doesn't take long to get anywhere in this place. We don't have the miles and miles of roads that that you have or Australia had. We can get anywhere very quickly.
What's so ironic about that is that Mel and I both live within 3 miles of where we grew up to. So
Yeah, I live in the exact spot where I grew up.
Mel's within 300 feet of where she grew up. So
Yes. Well, welcome, Judy. It's so great to have you.
thank you.
And also, probably a bummer because I'm guessing that you are one of us,
I am.
the Widow Club. So, we're going to get to that in a bit. Tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into it. What are some things that you do for fun? Do you have a job? Do you have animals? Do you like the royal family, or do you have hard feelings against the royal family? Whatever you want to answer.
Right. I was married for 38 years, together with my husband for 44. We've got 3 grown-up children and 6 grandchildren. And as I said, I've lived in this area all my life. My first love and my first job was working with racehorses. I used to break the youngsters and ride the fit ones back to health. So we would break them and get them training fit. That was when I was young and thin and brave, which I'm none of those anymore. But I did that for 30 years. Best job in the world. No money to speak of. Terrible hours and not fitting having a family. So I did give that up when I was 48. Which was sad but inevitable, but loved it, absolutely loved it. So that was my first love, as the job goes. I don't do that now because everything's changed, because you get responsible and you get unfit and you get fearful. Yeah. You have to be pretty reckless to do that. And I sometimes can't believe I ever did. But that was my big love. Then we were married. As I said, we knew each other when I was 18 and he was 21. So we were very young.
Wait, please tell me he was the stable hand, because that's such a Hallmark movie situation. You're the horse trainer.
Still a good story. He wasn't anything to do with horses. Nothing to do with horses. Our parents knew each other before they were married. Both our sets of parents knew each other before they were married. They were friends. So we knew each other right from the day one. But we didn't, but we weren't necessarily friends because we were kids. We were just kids. Our fathers joined the Royal Air Force on the same day, and our mothers used to walk the kids around her, you know, together, share maternity clothes, all that sort of stuff. So we knew of each other forever. Then they went away. They went abroad because his father took him abroad with his job, and he came back. About 20 years old, and he worked for my father, who worked in a sports ground. And I used to, and so that sort of, and they formed a partnership. And then I went to work away. I left home and went to work with horses up in the country. And every summer I would come back, and my father would, in the summer it was a closed season for my work, and so I'd come back and do some earning money. Working with my father and my boyfriend, became my boyfriend. So we got to know each other again, but we'd known each other all our lives. I remember him, my first memory was when I was about six, and I was friends with his sister, and I went round to their house to play party games. And I was a very nervous, very shy girl. And there was all these brothers. I thought there was about 20 of them. There was actually only five. But I had, you know, when you're little, and they're all tall. And I just remember being terrified of these boys. But consequently, when I was 18, I came back from the work I was doing and joined the company. And my husband and I, was going to be my husband, worked together every day together. It's fantastic. And so there's a story there. He wasn't the stable hand, knew nothing about horses. I don't know quite where the love of horses came from. Nothing to do with my parents. But we were together all the time, and we worked together pretty much most of our lives, right up until the end. So that was lovely. So, yes, we were married for a fairly good time, but we were also together in any job we did. We seemed to find, you know, a part each in whichever job we came up, but not the horses. He was never to do with the horses.
So you were basically married from birth to this
yes,
guy.
Yes, basically.
What's his name?
Richard.
Richard.
Mm. Richard. And if you know, I don't know if you know English talk hosts.
No.
But there's sort of Richard and Judy, like a famous talk host couple. And so it's a standard in England that you just go Richard and Judy, and they're like, oh, yeah, funny, huh? So that's a sort of funny joke. They're sort of British TV hosts.
Oh. See, distinguished. Are they distinguished?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just the poorer version of the TV version, but you know, I'll take that. My interest now, I've taken early retirement because I worked in a nursing home, very close by, for the last 15 years because we were self-employed. We're both self-employed. That whole self-employed nightmare of trying to keep it all together and not having a regular holiday income, etc. So when Richard turned 50, he was offered a job at a nursing home as an estate manager, looking after maintenance and gardens. And I said, well, he sort of said jokingly, perhaps you could get a job there. And I thought, I don't want to work with old people. No disrespect, it all comes back, but no disrespect to old people. I was working with fast animals, and now you know, downsized to
slow animals,
old people. I had not long lost my dad, and I just sort of thought, I swear, I'm never going to work with old people. Anyway, there was a 3-month window to work in the bar stroke coffee bar at this place, and I said emphatically, I'm here for 3 months, that's it, I'm not staying. 15 years later, we did 15 years together, and then after Richard died, I went back for 3 months, but I couldn't do it without him. It was too haunting and not the same. People started changing, they didn't know him, you know, you just lose that familiarity. And so I took the drastic action of taking early retirement just before I went on my trip to Australia.
So you need to tell us what happened to Richard.
Richard was he was a very fit man, a sportsman, you know, a social drinker. He was everybody's buddy. 8 years ago, or 8 years before he died, he was diagnosed with colorectal cancer, which he maintained incredibly. It brought out a side of him that I honestly didn't know was there. He was a very quiet, proud man. But he dealt with it brilliantly. And the last 4 years were terminal, but he worked full time until 3 weeks before he died. He was stoic as ever. So we had eight years of knowing, or certainly the last 4 years of knowing where this was going. You'll understand, it ended really well. It was a beautiful ending. We were so, so lucky with timing and treatment and the support from work, and this everything was just incredible. So yeah, it's, of course, it's absolutely awful, but I don't have any regrets, and that I think makes a big difference to the grieving process and the process I'm going through now. And it was a year ago, he died last Friday, it was the anniversary, so it was a year that he's since he died. But
it hasn't been very long.
It hasn't been long, no, and with all the stuff you have to do, you know. But it's okay, you know. It's as okay as it can be, and I'm grateful for that, and I'm lucky because not people just doesn't happen like that. We were lucky with the treatments that he had. He didn't suffer too badly with the treatments. We had lots of treatments. He had lots of trials, and he did continue to do the trials even when he knew they wouldn't help him, because he wanted to help the next person. It made him a better person. It brought out compassion. It brought out massive support for the local cancer hospital that looked after him, the work which I'm continuing. It just made him. I mean, my son said this. It said the last 8 years, Mum, he said, it's actually made him, because he his example was incredible. And it was humble as well. It wasn't in your face. He didn't go on about it. If people asked, he'd happily tell them, but he'd never say, you know, not a poor me sort of character, or a, oh, this is awful. You know, he never blamed anybody or complained. It was incredible. And I'm very proud of him for that, because it was, you know, it brought out the depth of somebody that I didn't realize it, in a way. And I loved him all the more for it. And it was exemplary.
8 years is a long time to be dealing with the stress of that. I would think that that would be really hard. And we see this a lot, you know, when you go through something that's really difficult, it has a tendency either to push people together, or sometimes it has the tendency to push people apart. And sometimes it's a little of each, you know, as you go through the bumps of that. But it sounds like it really pushed you guys towards each other.
He didn't talk about it, but it wasn't because he wouldn't talk about it. He didn't see the point. He was man of few words, and he said, I was a typical woman, I wanted to, you know, yeah, what if, what about this, what about what happens, what about if this happens. And he said, we'll talk about it when there's something to talk about. It's all ifs, buts and maybes at this stage. So I was, and I respected that, but I was you know, not, oh, I want to talk about it.
It sounded very, very pragmatic. Judy, I have a question just for us and our listeners who are not British and are not familiar with the healthcare system over there. And will you explain a little bit to us and our listeners about what cancer treatment can look like. How is it paid for? Is it NHS? What is the NHS? Will you give us a little overview for us Americans over here who don't know?
Right. His treatment didn't cost a penny.
Wow.
It all on the National Health Service, the NHS, which I don't care what anybody says, is incredible. We all pay a national insurance through our wages. Every single person in the country pays an NI, a very small amount, but it means that all healthcare is free. So we all the scans, all the treatment that I know cost thousands, never cost us a penny.
Wow.
Not a single thing. And work didn't ever penalise him in time taken to attend his appointments and so forth. But we were blessed, seriously blessed, by being literally 3 minutes' drive from the hospital. The Royal Marsden Hospital is the cancer hospital in England. People move to be near it. They travel hundreds of miles to be near it, and it was on our doorstep. We were very lucky. But no, cost us nothing. And hence his desire to raise money. And he did the thing called the Marsden March, which is a annual, as it says, suggests, a long walk. There's two hospitals. There's a hospital in Chelsea in London, and there's a hospital in Sutton, which is the near one to us. And every year, thousands of people walk from Chelsea to Sutton, and they get fundraised and they raise thousands and thousands. But I tell you what, the amount of money they must spend, because he was having scans and treatments well after it was terminal. You know, a lot of people could say, well, that's it, nothing more we can do. They were doing treatment and scans on him right up until the end. It was incredible. So, and he was very keen on raising money for them. And I am now joined into the research team as a carer, stroke partner. Because it's the least I can do. And we gave, when he died, we raised money from people, and we gave it to the Royal Marsden in the form of tangible stuff, not just in their sort of liquid fund. We bought put me up beds for all, so that partners of people that were end of life could stay overnight. So we bought some really nice put me up beds that go next to them, and I bought a lot of stuff for the staff from like decent coffee machines and just simple stuff, but stuff that was just, you could just get your hands on. And the three places that we supported, which were close to his heart, we bought these tangible things for. So his name lives on in engraved things in three places, because he really was passionate about supporting them. So I continue that as best I can.
Thank you for that explanation. I think it's so foreign to some people to think about not having to pay for all of that. Sounds quite nice, actually.
It means that you can accept everything that's offered to you. You can, you're the best possible position you can be. And it was a colorectal cancer that spread to his liver, but it wasn't liver cancer. The liver was a host. So strangled the liver at the end of the day. But I think his attitude to exercise, to diet, his positive attitude, I think gave him 3 years longer than they expected.
I love what you said about how even after it was considered terminal, that he still continued to participate to help those that came.
Yeah.
And here's something that's interesting, just between, I don't know, my little world over here in Utah and your world over there. My family has colorectal cancer in it. And so my aunts and uncles, you know, everybody, they have to get scanned for it. Well, they're in their 70s. Their mom died from it. And they went to get a scan at age 70, whatever. And the doctors are like, okay, well, we scraped off things and you're good to go. That's the last one you'll ever need. And they're like, wait, in our lives? And the doctor's like, well, yeah. And they're like, well, our mom died from this. Don't you think that as we age, we should be continuing to come in even sooner? And it's weird. It's almost like the way that the patients felt, my family members were, you just are waiting for us to die. And like, you don't really care about our health. So I'm like listening to your story and I'm like, that's amazing. And then I know this other part over here where it's like, what is going on? So thank you, NHS, for helping our British friends.
I'll not hear a word against it because, and they deal with hundreds and hundreds of people, as you can imagine. But they think, I think, my gut feeling is that years ago, I think it's environmental because he's worked on sports grounds all his life, did work on his, all his life, well before PPE, you know, protection, was it personal protection equipment came in, so masks and all that stuff came in that you're supposed to wear. He was spreading fertilizers and moss killer and, you know, and all these chemicals, weed killer, that are now banned. But he was doing that as like everybody, as everybody was, not recklessly, because people didn't think about it. And I think he just absorbed an awful lot of poison in those years. Now, I, of course, I could be wrong, and it's not a family thing, or hasn't been. But it's now, when I think back and how many chemicals went into the ground, which is what it did back in the, you know, 70s and 80s, I'm not surprised if that was a catalyst. Because everything's changed now. The PPE has changed and the chemicals have changed. But there was a lot of stuff used on specific sports surfaces to keep them as plush as they were.
So, Judy, you mentioned that Richard was stoic and not a man of many words. And so I wonder if you ever did get to have those conversations that you were really wanting to have early on, and he didn't. Did you kind of find your way into those conversations? I mean, 8 years is a long time to be doing that.
A lot of it was done in a jokey way. A lot of it was done with dark humor. A lot of it was done in me sort of watching his reaction to perhaps other people's misfortune. But he would quite happily make a joke of it. Mm-hmm. And then you could sort of think, oh, okay. One time when we got a good conversation was after a friend's funeral, literally. In fact, the funeral was a year to the day before he died. And so we had a drive back, and it was the same sports club people. So there was all, it was like a dress rehearsal because it was the same crowd, the same, you know. And he went, oh, well, that's obviously what it's going to look like. And this was at a crematorium. And I said, oh, please, can we not do it at a crematorium? I want something where you're not timed in and out, and you're not, you know, one's in, one's out, and it's all official, and you, this, da, da, da. I wanted something much more casual, much more individual, really. So I learned little snippets. So I sort of listened and absorbed bits. And he chose a lot of music. I came down once, for instance, at 5 o'clock in the morning and found that he'd been on the sofa all night. And he went, I've got my funeral music. And he played two or three pieces. And I thought, okay. So I logged it. You know, it was subtle, but I wasn't going to nag, and I wasn't going to, it was his journey, not mine. And I just sort of noted what was going on. But I did also joke every time. I'd said, I know what you're going to do. Because he was never one for great gushing romantic sort of offerings. And, you know, it was always a tease. I'd say, I love you. And he'd go, thank you. And I'd like hit him, and then he'd say, yeah, I love you too. You know, he wasn't one for sort of gushing. And I said, I know what you're going to do. You're going to say all this on your deathbed, aren't you? You're going to say all the good stuff on your deathbed. And he went, yeah, probably. And he did. He absolutely did. The day we said goodbye, which was an Easter Monday, he just said everything. It was the most incredible thing. And so I didn't mind that we hadn't had in-depth conversation, because he was right. What can you talk about? It's all about guesswork. But you know, he sorted out finances, and we spoke to the children. He was very open about it, but not unless asked. And if people asked how he was, he'd say. But he was not going to tell people unnecessarily. So I gleaned a lot from little sort of bits and pieces, and we weren't that precious about detail. He said in the couple of days before he died, he said, whatever you do, make it fun and enjoyable. And I did a fantastic memorial, not in a crematorium. We did it at the sports club with a big marquee, and we had a stage, and we had flowers, and we had speakers, and it was just magical.
It sounds like you needed 8 years to piece together.
Pretty much.
One. And it sounds like it was never head on. It always had to be sort of obliquely, you know, maybe not because you were avoiding it, but that just wasn't his style of communicating. So
it wasn't going to change us, and it wasn't going to define us. It was what it was. And he took it very bravely. And you know, he always used to say, I'm not ready to die. I don't want to die. I've got too much to do. But this is what's happened. I can't do any more than I've done. And that was the thing we'd both say, you can't do any more than you've done. You could not ever say, I wish I had done this, this, or this. He went through treatment after treatment, mostly without much side effects, mostly tiredness, I guess, and a few smaller things. But he wasn't prepared to go, but he was also going to still work. And as I said, he worked until 3 weeks before. And he organised a lot of local community things that to fundraise for the Marsden, and you know, so that he knew would be carried on after his death. So it made me proud. I mean, it made me smile. Of course, it made me sad, but I mean, it made me smile more than that, more than it made me sad, because I just thought, wow, this I'm after all these years, I'm still learning so much about you. And it was as we all know, it's a network thing. It taught the children how to cope. It's taught the grandchildren how to cope. And if ever they have a major thing in their life, they can always go, what an example. What a fantastic example.
I love that. So you've become a widow. Your husband has died. Of course, you're not ready for that. You don't want that to happen. It's probably just so hard to even wrap your head around what you're going to do next. What did you do?
What I did before he died, I always knew I had to be ready. And I couldn't be one of those people that got, you know, he's gone, and then what the hell do I do now?
Which is what Mel and
I
did.
But a friend, I said this out loud to a friend, and she said, have you read a book called The Salt Path? And I went, no. Anyway, briefly, it's about a couple who lost everything, who walked around the very southern tip of England. They were my age, and they'd lost everything due to personal problems. But they had each other, and they had a tent, and they had some old walking boots, and they walked what's called the Southwest Coast Path. And it's 600 miles, and it takes ages. And they just set off, and she wrote about it, and she wrote about it just to remind her of it. And anyway, the end of the story was the daughter found her writings and said, you should publish this. Consequently, it's become a bestseller. The one thing I didn't want was attention. I didn't want platitudes. I didn't want attention. I didn't want to have all those faces looking at me, and especially at work with all the people that knew him as well, going, oh, how are you? And oh, God. I thought, I can't do this. I need to run away. I need to get away. I want to be on my own. I want to reach the depths that I need to reach in my own time with solitude and peace, and face it in order to come back and cope. So because my daughter was in Australia, my version of doing the Salt Path was to go to Australia because she was due a baby, and she had a baby while I was there. And then I went off with a backpack that weighed 3 kilos around South Australia. And I went on buses and planes and coaches, 14 flights, 5 different countries. I went to Tasmania, New Zealand, South Africa to see my nephews on the way home. For 5 months, I just, I embraced it. It escaped, but I wanted the peace and tranquility of the beauty in Australia, which is vast blue sky, sea, massive amounts of sand with nobody on it. And I achieved that because that's where I got my peace. It was awful. I mean, I, you know, it was as beautiful as it was awful, because it was, I just stood on these beaches thinking, I'm the tiniest dot in this earth, but I could scream at the sky, I could cry in the sea. Nobody was trying to help me or make me better. I didn't want anybody to make me better. I wanted to get down there so that I could come up. And so I started writing in a bit in the style of the style of the book that I had read, that was my inspiration, about the rawness of it. And it's very, so I've written my book, it's just finished, and it's about the emotional and the physical and the geographical journey that I went on, trip that I went on. I don't like the word journey, bothers me, but I don't know why, it's a bit thrown out there. A lot of people use, oh, my journey, and I think, all right. But my actual physical trip was, it's, so I've written this book that is very honest, very real, but it's funny and it's true and it's light, positive, but also, you know, has its ebbs and flows. So, you know, if I have a bad day, then I write about it. And if I have a good day, I also write about it. So that was what I did. So I set off for Australia, didn't know where I was going. I had a ticket in and a ticket out. And I just stayed on the coast. That was the one rule. I wanted to stay on the coast because of the beauty. I didn't want to go into the cities. I didn't want to.
No, I wondered if you had gone into the middle of Australia.
No,
or if you had
no. Not the middle. I wasn't. No.
That would be very scary.
No. Exactly. No, there's too many weird animals out there. But the the coast is consistently beautiful, and the space and the air and the light. It's like a film set. It's just beautiful. So that really fed my soul, and that made me face my future and get on with it, because I didn't want to, it's never obviously, as you know, never going to go away, but I wanted to get on with it, because I didn't, how long do I have left to live? I can't dwell. It's changed my life, but I've still got a life to live, and he would be very cross if I would hadn't done this. He would be saying, you've got my pension, for Christ's sake, what do you do something with it? Don't just sit about moping.
Did you get any pushback from people trying to tell you that that was not a good idea, or that, you know, running away from your problems, quote unquote, was not going to help anything?
Not really. Not genuinely. I mean, I was, the writing was really about writing it for myself to start with. And I put out people, you know, when people say, oh, keep in touch, tell me where you are and what you're doing. And you think, I can't spend all day doing that. So I had a WhatsApp group of friends, and I felt a bit self-conscious. I thought, who wants to know who wants to really know this? I'm a bit not embarrassed, but you just think, who really wants to know the details of my life or my daily life? But I did. I braved it, and I put this WhatsApp group up. The response I got was just incredible. It was so kind, all these friends. So, no, I never actually got a negative out of it. People did the usual, oh, you're so brave and you're so strong. And I went, no, I'm not. I'm just dealing with
on
something.
On your journey. Yes, you're so brave and strong on your journey.
I'm not brave. I'm not strong. I'm just trying to deal with something that I have no control over, you know. So it was the sort of generous, kind, but the platitudes that I was escaping from. I didn't want to hear all that. I just didn't want to hear anything. I wanted to deal with it myself. And it grew. The plan grew. And with the help of my lovely daughter, and she helped look into stuff and, think of places to go and so forth. And it flowed. It was just beautiful. I had 14 flights. I'd never had a bad flight. I never had bad weather. It just makes me smile, because something was helping me out there, and it was just the most perfect experience. And I didn't feel alone out there. It's a very good place to travel. You feel very safe. They're very amenable people. They're very funny, and they're very laid back. It's a nice lifestyle. So I felt very at ease, and I had my backpack. I had 4 t-shirts, 2 pairs of shorts, a couple of pairs of knickers, and washed everything in sinks and just hang it out on a chair, because it was so hot, everything dried really quickly.
Did you stay mostly in hotels, or did you ever have to camp on the beach,
park bench?
No, I didn't camp. I'm not that young. I couldn't camp and I didn't want to be eaten by something. But I stayed. I was going to hire a car, and then we looked at the cost and it was crazy. And also you don't see the view. So I stayed in sort of chalets on the beach, beach cottages, some hotels, but sort of cheap hotels that like travel hotels, not motels, but hotels that are perhaps designed for, say, commuters. So they're sort of overnight, they're looked after, rented apartments. So you just pay, it's not very expensive. I splashed out in a couple of very nice hotels in some areas, but it's not expensive out there. And I thought, well, this is what I want comfort. I want to enjoy it. I don't want to suffer. And so I stayed in some beautiful places and over there, everything has got a view. It was all about the views, really. I just wanted to be near the sea.
So you mentioned that you didn't want to hear platitudes and wanted to go through this on your own, away from your regular life. I'm curious, when you met people in Australia, did they ask you why you were traveling, and did you share some of your story, or did you keep it to yourself?
I learned very quickly what to say. I kept it to myself probably most of the time, depending on who you met. And of course you meet people on planes because there were so many flights, and people in restaurants. You gauge, I mean, you know, you gauge how much you say. I regret one oversharing once, because they turned out to be extremely religious, and I'm not religious.
That's not where I thought you were going to go.
No. And they were telling me, and I was like, oh my God, they just sucked me in. And they didn't suck me in, but they tried to. And I just thought, no. I regretted it. I thought, stop it. You know, I just felt very, that was probably the only time I sort of felt vulnerable. I thought, no, I'm not doing this. So then I learned to gauge what to say, and to say it proudly and to say it lightly. I didn't want, I didn't want all the faces. I didn't want all the awkwardness. I didn't want to put people, you know, it's nothing worse than the two things I got a lot of people who said, oh, what are you doing? And, oh, I'm going around Australia. Well done. How wonderful. What a marvelous holiday. And you think, not a holiday. Mm. But then if you go and bum them out by saying, oh, I've just lost my husband, then they're like, oh, this is awkward. So, but also if you don't say anything, then it gets to the point where you can't say anything. So they've gone, you know, you just think, oh my God, oh, this is awkward. So I learned very quickly to gauge when you'd felt that you'd met a sort of mutual friend, or when you'd met somebody that it was none of their business or such like. So I didn't share.
I would just want to share so I could get a free appetizer, you know, like.
Oh, you can play that. Oh, yeah. Play the widow card anytime you like. Yeah, absolutely. There's a time and a place. Yes. But most of the time I it was bright and breezy, you know, I'm traveling on my own. And if they ask more, then that's fine. But you could tell if it was where the conversation was going, pretty much. But I did learn. I made mistakes.
Did you meet any other widows or widowers on your travels?
Yes, actually. I met one lovely lady. And ironically, it was on the shortest plane journey. And she was the sort of person I could have talked to for ages, you know. And unfortunately, it was like an hour-long flight. And I was just thinking, oh, damn, you know, I'm just about to land. And I was really getting to know you. I was traveling so much, it was all brief. It was all pretty brief, which is what it suited me. I was still very keen on solitude. I didn't want to get involved. I wanted to keep moving. I just felt this need to keep moving further and further away from home, I guess. I think looking back, I was going as far as I possibly could. But as I said, I was going to Australia anyway because of my daughter, but it's a big place, and I was just going as far away as I could to find this peace, really.
So Mel and I went to Australia for Camp Widow in what year was it, Mel? 2021? 2022? 2022.
Sure.
I think it was 2022. And we
Where
were
did
like,
you go?
oh, well, we were like, let's just drive from Sydney to the Great Barrier Reef. Let's
oh, yeah,
just
that's
go.
close.
Let's
Yeah,
just go have a little
that's
day trip.
Wrong.
Yeah, we learned that that's not really an option and felt
No.
a little dumb about that. We're actually going back in less than a month. We're
Are
going to be
you?
back in
Yeah.
Australia.
Same
Yes.
place?
Yeah, we're not going to drive to the Great Barrier Reef from Sydney
No.
this time, though.
We will
The
fly
Camp Widow
there.
is in Brisbane, so we'll be
Oh,
going back to
yeah.
Brisbane. But we are going to fly to Port Douglas and the Great
Oh, yeah.
Barrier Reef. So
Lovely.
we need
Yeah.
your itinerary. We
Yeah.
need all your
Oh,
tips.
and we are
it
impressed
was
that you did not get
amazing.
attacked by the murder birds, which we learned about when we were there.
The what?
Murder
The
birds.
murder birds, the magpies that try and attack your head.
Yes, don't go. They're breeding season. No.
Yes.
I was very lucky with animals. I didn't come across more. I came across more in South Africa. As I said, my sister lives there with my nephew, so I wanted to. I came back that way, but it's a long journey because you have to stop in Mauritius. You know, oh, damn, and then you have to, which I sort of eked out for 3 days, and then you go to Johannesburg, then Durban, and then there was a long drive. The weather at that time was humid, hot. Australia was hot, hot, but this was humid, hot. And the bugs and the things were just way worse than Australia. So I didn't enjoy that. So I was very lucky with animals in Australia. So I'm sure there are experiences, but I didn't come across any nasty experiences there. So that's why I think I have fond memories of it. But
What was your favorite? Do you have a favorite place that you were able to visit or something that really just spoke to your soul?
Tasmania, because it was the timing. I had a huge emotional shift there, and I found what I was looking for. The first time I found what I was looking for, as in the peace, the solitude, the beauty. And I'd had the time then to adjust. I'd had the I was it was just timing, and everything was fantastic. And that holds a huge piece of my heart. Because I just had that shift when you've gone past all the rubbish stuff and then all the journey stuff. And I sort of landed there for a week, and I went up to a little chalet that was in the dunes overlooking the sea with, I don't know where anybody was. I honestly, it was like there was an apocalypse. It was just like, have I missed something? Because there's nobody anywhere. And I had this huge miles and miles of beach to myself. And a beautiful little cabin with like a log burner and a beautiful bed and a full kitchen, and that's where I started writing, and I suddenly just got this urge to start. And so that's where I would go again. It's a beautiful place, and it's very lush, and it's not like Australia. It's very green and mountainous, and just so beautiful. And I think it was just the timing. I just went to this place and I just thought, this is what I imagined when I was on my own. This is what how I imagined it to be, and it just got better from then on. I think that was a massive turning point. I had a real shift then.
That's cool.
I'm curious, when you were done with your travels and you went back home, how was re-entering that situation for you?
Initially, the first 3 days was a joy because South Africa was so
Awful.
hot, awful. I mean, bless South Africa. I mean, it's beautiful. Don't get me wrong, but no. So breathing cold air, everybody was saying, oh, you're coming back to England. It's all cold. And I just thought, it's like being in an oven night and day in South Africa. I don't want to sweat all day, all night long. I want to breathe cold air. And I came into the house. I had my own bed, my own toilet, my own kitchen. I'd been living out of a backpack for all this time. It was absolute relief. And it only really hit me 3 days after. And then I suddenly thought, oh, this is our home, and I've got this huge space and I don't like it. But it's a light, nice house, it's a small house, and it suits me. I moved back into our bedroom because I'd moved out because I kept snoring when he was trying to recover from treatment. So I got kicked out. So I moved back to our bedroom, and that was harsh because it's all, the ceiling that you've stared at together, that sort of thing. But it's okay, you know, it's okay. But initially, the first 3 days was I was on an absolute buzzing, and then it hit me. But yeah, what to do? You can't do anything but carry on.
Yeah,
and it was the new year, so there was a sense of hope regarding like the weather and the daylight and so forth.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about your story and your journey, because I made direct eye contact when I said that, everybody.
Yeah, I know.
Because you are very positive and you have looked for all of the things that went well in your situation. And another person could have gone through that exact same situation and talked about all the things that didn't go well, because like it or not, there are a lot of things in your situation that did not go well because your husband ended up dead. So it's just a testament to kind of how you have processed and are dealing with this, because you have been very, I don't know if good is the right word, or if you've made an effort to do this, to really seek out the things that are positive in your situation and really kind of hang on to those.
Mm. I think I was led by Richard, honestly. When, you know, first heard the diagnosis, I just thought my world had collapsed, and I was thinking his world has collapsed, mine hasn't. You know, this is his cancer, not my cancer. What have I got to moan about? You know, he knew he was going to die, and I just thought, how awful. I'm not, and therefore he I definitely fed off his positivity and his attitude. And so he taught me that, and I kept a lot in, I kept a lot suppressed, I kept a lot, frustratingly, as I said, wanting to talk about it, but I thought, no, I've got to do it his way, because he's the one that's actually going to die, you know, I'm not. And what's the alternative? Seriously, what's the alternative?
Rage?
Yes, rage. Or you turn into a complete hermit and you don't go out. You know, it's destructive. It's destructive. And I mean, I cry 2 or 3 times a day still, and probably always will. But it's like an overflow. It's not a wretch, gut-wrenching cry. It's just a sadness. It's a cloak of sadness that will never go. But I can't. I wrote something in my book, and I said, try not to thrive on grief. It's a dangerous but necessary beast. Keep it as your constant companion, but not your master. And I just thought, I can't let this destroy me, because I've got children and I've got grandchildren and I've got the luck of living for however long. I'm not going to ruin it. I've chosen to do the things that I want to do by not working, although I loved work. By not working, I've been able to concentrate on writing, which I love. And there's different excitements in life. And I mean, it has only been a year, but it could destroy you. I don't want to be destroyed.
Is your book available yet? Or is it, what's, where are you in that process?
I'm self-publishing. I finished it. I had today, funnily enough, I had a meeting with the guy that's going to do the cover for me. I had a meeting a couple of days ago with a friend that's going to do the design and layout, and I've got a brother-in-law, luckily enough, who's in printing, so he's going to print it for me. So I'm hoping to get it out within the next 2 or 3 months.
What are you naming the book?
It's called Caught in a Riptide, and it's like R.I.P. tide.
I love that.
which is quite Australian. And what I didn't mention is that 3 months before my husband died, my mother died. And 3 months before that, my dog died. And I mean, you know, I'm a dog person, and he was going to be the one that was going to support me through these imminent deaths. And he died. And I just thought, oh, great. You know, now I've got nobody. So my mum was old. She was 95, and she was in the nursing home where I worked. A natural progression, quite obviously. But they were all ill at the same time. And I just thought, oh, please have a gap. Please, because selfishly, I want to give you the respect and love that you deserve, Mum, but I also need to look after my husband. And, anyway, they gave me 3 months, which was just about
like just bare minimum.
Yeah. 90 days.
Yeah. So, Caught in a Riptide isn't a sort of Australian thing, but the RIP meant the loss of the three things, people that I loved most.
Yeah, I like the analogy of the riptide as well, because when you're in a riptide, the advice that you're given is not to try and swim against the riptide, but kind of swim perpendicular to it. So not try and fight against it.
No. And it's like two steps forward, one step back. You know, yeah. It's a strong, strong force.
Yeah. And it has a lot of grief, you know, it's a kind of an allegory towards that.
And I was never going to busy myself through this, because I think if you busy yourself through it, or don't embrace it, or deny it, then it comes back and bites you in some other way. And so I knew I had to, as I said before, reach that sort of low point, allow those low points to happen so that I could sort of climb back up again.
Oh, Judy, thank you so much for sharing with us. We can't wait to hear an update about when the book comes out. I think it's going to be really cool to hear about your travels and the lessons that you have learned. I think we have also established that, yes, you are very distinguished, and we appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Thank you. Well, I'm most grateful to be invited. I really, really appreciate it.
Yes. We hope you guys have enjoyed hearing Judy's story. I'm a little jealous of her travels all over the world, but not the South Africa part, I guess.
No. Sorry. I'll be in trouble with the South African travel board. Yeah.
We do have one final question for you. And yeah. This could be either from your travels or in your regular life. What is your favorite cheese?
Cheese? Jeez, that's a good one. I like smoked cheese. I like a smoked cheese. Okay. A hard smoked cheese.
A hard smoked cheese. We'll put you down for that.
As long as I've got a good red wine to go with it.
Okay. If you guys want to help keep the podcast going, will you check out our Patreon? It's patreon.com/WWDN.
If you'd like to buy us tacos, go to buymeacoffee.com/widowwedonow.
And we always appreciate a nice rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And until we get to talk to you again, I'm Anita.
I'm Mel.
And I'm Judy.
And we are just two young widows and one widow who avoided being eaten by any strange Australian animals. And we're still not clear on her stance on the royal family, but that's okay.
Oh, no. I'm for them. I'm very royal. I love the royal family.
And we're all just trying to figure out, widow.
We
do
now. This is my favorite thing to discuss with you.
Tell me, what is it?
One of my favorite things. I do enjoy tacos and cheese and dogs. This is about how you cannot pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a phone plan, especially when you're a widow, your person is dead, you might have kids, you might need another option, and you just want your phone to work, you want unlimited texting and service, and you want it to be like $25 a month.
It blows my mind that they have plans that start at $15 a month. That is so cheap. And the cool thing is it uses other 5G networks, and so you don't have to pay extra for that, and you still get great service.
Yep. Anita and I have traveled all over, and I have used my phone. So I highly recommend it. And my mom's even on it. When my dad died, we put his phone down to the cheapest plan, which is $15 a month. And I think my mom's on the $20 a month plan, and it's so worth it. It's so much cheaper than what we were all paying before. So I highly recommend it if you're on a budget or not. Who cares? Ryan Reynolds is in charge of the company, and they send you free stickers with Ryan Reynolds temporary tattoos. It's kind of the best. So if somebody wants to sign up, what can they do, Anita?
Go to trymintmobile.com/WWDN. Seriously, you guys, such a great idea. Save yourself some money.
And if you're worried about losing data or having any changes with your phone, not going to happen. They walk you through it. Everything's fine. It's the easiest process of all time. Again, that's
trymintmobile.com/WWDN.